Hello, welcome everyone. Can you all hear me? Good. Okay, welcome to the sanctuary and welcome to the Happiness, Health and Wellbeing Conference, jointly organised by the Bishara Trust and the Edinburgh International Centre for Spirituality and Peace. My name is Jim Mooney, or James Mooney, whichever you prefer. I'm a philosopher. I'm based at the University of Edinburgh at the Open Studies Department. And I'm really happy to be here. I'm really happy to have been asked to open this conference, which will take place over the next couple of days. And tonight's events, which are going to consist of a keynote speech and then a forum. And let me just get some housekeeping out the way for you, if you don't mind. The fire exit, should there be an emergency, is the way that you came in, although there is also another exit over this way. The bathrooms are out towards the exit and then take a left. Okay? Is everyone all right with that? Good. Okay. Let me just run down quickly what tonight will consist of. I won't keep you for very long at all, just a few minutes, and then I'm going to hand over to the keynote speaker, who will speak for 40 minutes, taking us up to around 7:45, and then hopefully there'll be an opportunity for you to ask lots of questions. At 8 o'clock, we will then commence with a panel, where each speaker will speak for 10 minutes, and then again, at the end, once everyone's spoken, we will open for questions. And at the end of proceedings, there'll be an opportunity for us all to have a refreshment together. Okay. Now, when I was asked to do this, I did some preparation in the way that all academics do preparation. I went on to Facebook, and I asked my friends from across the world, and just two words, I put, happiness is dot, dot, dot. And I got so many replies, just unbelievable amount of conversation that went on. Some of the replies I got, I noted down a cigar called Hamlet. That was the first one that I got, and so I wasn't too sure of what quality would come. But then it got better, and people were speaking about inner peace, about being at one with nature, a sense of balance. Someone also sent me a link to a TED conference on the subject. Someone sent me a copy of Time magazine. And I also got a short film that was made by a friend when they were 16 years old at school on the subject. And I think what this shows is how important it is to so many people, the fact that I got so many replies. But I think it also shows how it can be so many different things for so many different people as well. So I think it's wonderful that we have panelists and contributors and participants in the audience and on the stage over the next 2 days from so many different fields, from the arts, from the sciences, from spiritualism, cookery, all sorts of ranges of things. Now, as well as going on Facebook, I did actually do a little bit of proper research, and I saw what philosophers, I'm a philosopher myself, so I thought, what did philosophers say about happiness? And sadly, not a great deal. But there are some notable exceptions. And so I looked to Plato, which is where I always look. And for Plato, that's markedly similar to many of the people who'd spoken on Facebook about a sense of balance, you know, a sense of inner harmony. But importantly, even if you'd achieved this inner harmony, you could only be truly happy if you lived in a happy society. Aristotle, Plato's pupil, he speaks about happiness as developing the virtues. But these virtues can only be exercised in the polis, with other people. And if we exercise them to the right degree, then we will reach that state he calls eudaimonia, which we can describe as human flourishing. I suppose the other notable philosopher is Jeremy Bentham, the British philosopher from the 19th century. Now for him, happiness is the key to everything. All personal decisions, all policy decisions should be made on one simple basis, that which will bring about the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And I think that he would be absolutely overjoyed by the work of the World Happiness Report, and the happiness index, this attempt to try and quantify happiness. And I think you'd be really, really happy at the attempt to reframe the debate in terms of this. So I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I think the fact that all of these philosophers have spoken not just about happiness from the inside, but from the outside, from the society that we come from, is really important. And I think it leads really neatly into our keynote speech tonight. I'd like to welcome Robin McAlpine. Robin is the director of the Jimmy Reid Foundation, I hope. And he's also the editor of the Scottish Left Review. Yeah. And has written on politics and various other subjects. Tonight he's going to talk to you about happiness as a political choice. So I'd like you to join me in welcoming him with a short round of applause.
And what a pleasure in Britain in 2013 to be a social progressive on the left and being invited to talk to something which wasn't about the misery of poverty or the iniquities of the benefit system. To be invited to come and talk to you about happiness is just a plain relief as a change of subject, never mind anything else. But just as I've been wandering around talking about benefits and welfare and poverty and the breakdown in social cohesion and all these various problems, and in every single one of those, I refuse to make it about poverty, but to be about hope. Likewise, while I am going to be talking much here about happiness and how we can see it as a specific political choice, you can't really understand it without talking about misery, anxiety, panic, fear, desperation, and the undue pressure that we're placed under in society. And, I mean, I've read about happiness in a number of contexts for a number of years. I've looked at a number of the indicators that have been developed to try and measure happiness, and some of the material which was looking at modern approaches to happiness as politics. And I've got to say that I've not been desperately convinced definitionally by what they are describing as happiness in a lot of these cases. I'm thinking, for example, of the Richard Laird book, there was a lot of really valuable stuff and it was genuinely interesting to read, but when his answer is happiness is pharmaceuticals, which was a large part of his drive, that we need to treat medically the process of not happiness to make it happiness. And yet, a few pages earlier in the book, when he was talking about what are the sources of happiness, what are the things that make us happy, he saw as legitimate, for example, religion. I agree. I mean, it's a legitimate thing if it makes you feel happy. I'm personally an atheist, and I think it's a misplaced happiness, is my personal view, but I'm happy for people who are happy through their religion. And then 2 pages later, he says, this doesn't apply to drugs, because people who smoke marijuana or take cocaine, that's not real happiness because it's chemical. But wait a minute, you just said 3 pages ago that it was okay to have non-real happiness if it's a belief in a mythical creature, he also being an atheist. So I think we should take a fairly broad definition of what is happiness. And I think, largely, it is the absence of misery and anxiety and panic. And we find that expression in all sorts of ways, which is more than simply a measurable endorphin rush or a dopamine hit. It's a different sort of a thing. It's a sort of a complex set of sensations and feelings and interactions and things that we have that make us feel good in the moment at various moments, at various times and in various different ways. And it's not a uniform thing. So let's look at it that way around. Let's have a look at how do you free up people from the things which are definitely going to prevent them having a shot at happiness and let them find their own way to whatever is their happiness. There's one message that I want to get across tonight. It's that we have a fundamental problem in our society. And the fundamental problem is as easy as could be to describe. Happy people don't shop. This is a fact. It's a point blank, straightforward fact. Happy people do not shop. So let's run back to about the 1920s, when there's a guy called Edward Bernays, who's one of the fathers of the concepts of advertising and of public affairs. He's a very intelligent man. I mean, genuine, had he not been in the commercial realm, I suspect a lot of people would have considered him a philosopher, but he was in the commercial realm. And what he realised was that with the strides forward that we had in productive capitalism, post-industrial revolution, post-globalisation of markets, international trade made all things possible, spices were no longer an unimaginable luxury. In this period, the capacity to meet people's desire is no longer sufficient to turn a profit, because the system is built on the need to generate more and more profit through more and more trade and more activity. And what Bernays realised was, if we are going to move forward as capitalists, we have to manufacture desire. It is the manufacture of desire in which we can move from that state where people have desires which are meetable to a state where desire can never be met, because as soon as it's met, the aim is to ensure that more desire is created. So we take this idea of the manufacture of desire and we look at it in reality, and it's out there. And I mean, I've done this, this was years ago, and I'd written this, and I just suggested, here's a game, try it, take a shot. Sit for an evening in front of a commercial TV station with a blank pad and a pen. And each time a commercial break comes on, each time the adverts come on, don't think too much, just after each advert, scribble down what you were supposed to take from it. Do that for an evening and have a quick look at your notepad. It will read as follows. Your house is shit. Your car's shit. Your girlfriend's kind of ugly. You probably smell. Your hair's not right. You haven't got enough stuff. That's not cool. You're not good. Really? Pull it together. Get out. Buy something. Now, if you think that sounds almost ironic, it's not. Talk to people in the advertising agency. You do not get anywhere by making people happy about who they are. Because when they're happy about who they are, they do things like go to the park. So what you have to do is make sure that they're not happy with who they are. That's how you sell things. And it's, I mean, it's categorical. It's the implication of how you light a picture. You look at anything, something as mundane as Shake and Vac. From the 1980s, which is, you know, how puerile, how no thought went into that. That is an incredibly effective advert. Nobody doesn't know the song. Even people who weren't alive at the time vaguely know the song. And it's lit very straightforwardly. There's a woman jumping around a house and it's all greys and toned down, and then afterwards it's not. Now, which, they turn up the contrast, they turn up the colours, they turn up the volume, then this is the house you want. Now, which house do you think they believe you're going to come away from that believing you currently live in? That's the purpose of advertising, and it's everywhere. Saturation advertising has started to cause impacts which I don't think we have even began to understand. I mean, I'm 40. When I was a kid, buses didn't have adverts on them. As a general rule, if you were to walk down a street, you could pretty well get down it without anybody making you feel like you were shit. The chances of that happening now are zero. There is no space in the public realm which is not now saturated with messages telling you what's wrong with you, telling you to up your game. The psychological impact of this? Well, I don't know. I guess I'm perhaps of a generation whereby we weren't inculcated with this early enough. I find a lot of it silly. I don't really want to buy things anymore, and that's not just because I run a left-wing think tank, Sally doesn't really allow, but genuinely, I've got to a point where this stuff doesn't quite work. And yet the younger generation, this is the generation now, the ones who are coming through, teens, 20s, who have been hyper-marketed since birth. Since they were born, they were told, 7 years old, where's your push-up bra? Now, people talk about this in terms of sexualisation, early sexualisation of children. And actually, I'm not going to go into this tonight, but actually the sexualisation of children was comparatively normal through many eras of civilisation. Children are inquisitive and curious. That sort of assumption that there is no sexual inquisitiveness in a child until they are 16, that's a late Victorian, early Edwardian sort of a concept. What is different here is that they don't really care about the sexuality for the sexuality. It is simply a way of making young girls insecure. Insecurity creates profit, and that's how the whole system works all the way through. Now, if we're doing this to a new generation from birth, if we do this at the outset, what happens? What do they become? What do they understand? What can they see in their life. Let me tell you a story. Sunday, when I was a kid, hungover, mid-20s, turn 40 and you start referring to your 20s as being a kid. Mid-20s, been out with friends the night before, just at the pub, bit hungover, went round to my pal's house, we're all sitting round, kind of rough, let's do something today. What are we going to do? So we ran through it, and, 10-pin bowling, maybe, quite noisy, sore head. Cinema, quite sit still through the whole thing. We could go to, the aquatic, this is a swimming, they've got a special deal on, you can get on the tubes and you can do whatever, blah, blah, blah. We did this for a while, and it never really appealed. And then someone said, and this is, I make this up not at all, someone says, I've got a frisbee. And I thought to myself, sounds like that could be a giggle. Let's get a frisbee. I remember playing with a frisbee. That was fun. And we did. And 6 of us went up to the field. I will admit we did take a couple of bottles of beer, but nothing excessive. We went up to the field. It was a pleasant day. It was early autumn. And we threw a frisbee about for, I don't know, a couple of hours. The dog came, threw it to the frisbee. It was a great day. And I had this sudden sort of a conscious revelation. What happened to the frisbee? These are brilliant. £1.99. Years of fun. Genuinely years of fun in the beach, in the garden, the whole thing. And you ever wonder what happened to frisbees? Because there's nothing that went out of fashion. They didn't stop working. What's the problem with a frisbee? Well, it's £1.99 and it lasts a lifetime. Why would you advertise a frisbee? What insanity would take you to pay to try and persuade someone to buy a frisbee once early in their life? So they don't. There is no benefit whatsoever in selling you a frisbee, irrespective of how happy or otherwise it might make you. And if you think about what this means, if you think about the inherent social impact of that statement in itself, you can see the kind of, the Willy Loman, the Earth of a Salesman, inbuilt obsolescence. It's not even about obsolescence now. It's not even saying we want something to have a limited lifespan. It says we only want to engage with you as consumers in a relationship model which can strip from you on a continuous basis as much of your income as we can manage. That is the sole purpose of contemporary retail capitalism. If you are going to stop for a second and describe accurately what I just said there, you have a range of living creatures whose sole purpose is management for the continuous extraction of value inherent in those living creatures. What would you call it? It's farming. We are farmed. The human and contemporary society is farmed. It's the best expression of what we aim to do as an economy. If you look at the abortive recommendations for the revamp of George Square, if you were going to do it properly, if you took what they said was in their mission statement and you followed it through, it would have one inch entrance, it would have been narrow, and that entrance would have been lined for about a mile with shops. There would have been one exit. That also would have been about a mile long and lined with shops. And everything in between would have simply had enormous electromagnets under the ground to suck any change they hadn't already got out your pocket. That is the meaning of George Square's redevelopment. Has it ever occurred to you, we have absorbed this so completely, has it ever occurred to you what people mean when they say regeneration? If we get a square foot of space in a city now, what is the only thing that we can consider? Retail units. Possibly, if you're lucky, some leisure to go along with the retail units. Why? Because we're being farmed. This is simply a herding process to take our public space, and it is our public space, to take our public space and redesign it as a process of value extraction from us. And the economics of this, incidentally, are sheer madness. So, some brief economics here. The value creation in retail, where does it take place? The value creation comes from some poor lassie in a sweatshop in China who takes thread and makes cloth and takes cloth and makes push-up bras. That's the value creation. That's where the value is created. How is the value realised? By some guy who's, well, once they've shipped it over, by some guy on minimum wage driving it to a depot. Someone else in a depot sorting it out for sending on to their various retail outlets. And a bunch of folk, probably also not much above minimum wage, stacking the shelves. That's how the value is realised. From where is the value realised? Because this is our economic salvation. Where does it come from? Well, other than the occasional tourist, every single penny of the retail sector in Britain, or any economy, comes out of our pockets, our wealth. Now, how is this economic value creation? We are being used to realise the value created in a sweatshop. In return, we get junk we don't need and jobs. I'm going to do my bunny rabbit ears here. I'm going to remember I'm talking to the microphone. Jobs. But hold on a minute here. Are you making a profit? Because if you are, I'm presuming the value of the jobs you create must be less than the money, the value that you're taking out of our economy in the first place. And this is easily summed up in one simple question, which it amazes me that people don't ask this. If retail cures poverty, like we've been told it does, how come the second biggest shopping destination in Britain happens to be Glasgow, which is also the poverty capital of Britain? So this is a question. If retail cures poverty, why doesn't it? Why is it that when we see retail, we see poverty? Almost always. They go together. They're part of the same picture. Because retail creates poverty. And poverty, as I'll get onto at some point, oh my god, that's 20 minutes. Poverty, as I get onto at some point, is another key part of this problem here. So we've got this retail economy. And the impact of the retail economy on us is way weirder than people understand. I highly recommend, if anyone hasn't read it, The Wonderful Tales from the Mall by Ewan Morrison, which is a real kind of a really interesting book. It's part novel, but short stories built into a novel with a whole bunch of specific social analysis in it, and some of what I can only describe as word art, all merged together into one book, novel. And it's really interesting. It's basically about our life in malls and how they work. And there's one story in it about a woman who is being interviewed by market research people on her best ever purchase. What's your best ever purchase? It's a pair of shoes. She says, what was it you liked in the shoes? She says, I saw them years ago and they were really nice, and you know, I looked at them in the shop. I wasn't sure if I'd ever wear them, but you know, they look good. And you bought them? Oh no, they were far too expensive. She says, right, okay, so what happened? I said, well, I never thought about it again. A year and a half later, they were in the same shop on sale. And they were quite a decent price. So you went and you bought them? Oh no. Why not? Well, you know, I wasn't sure I was going to wear them. This is your best purchase. So what happened? He says, well, I was buying at the shop outside my work and I passed every day. I kept seeing them. And I kept thinking, you know, I can afford these and I might wear them. And so eventually she decided, to hell with it, I'm going to go into the shop. I'm going to buy these shoes. So she goes in. And just as she's about to pick them up, another woman comes and takes the shoes, the last pair in her size, and she's going to buy them. And this woman, by this point, over the course of that week, a couple of weeks, has got this built up in her head. This is the Holy Grail. These shoes are now invaluable. These cannot be left behind. So she grabs the woman and she says, listen, bitch, I've been looking at these shoes for a year and a half and I've been meaning to buy them for a week. Put them down or you're dead. I said, what's the shoes doing? I said, just try them on. She says, thanks. Took them up to the shop and bought them. She got them home. And the woman says, that was your best retail experience? Says, oh, aye. He says, now with the shoes? He says, I've never had them on. Now, if that sounds like madness, and it is madness, it's actually psychologically true. They've done this in I think it was MIT, one of the US universities, who did a proper psychological profile of the shopping experience. Now, what's the best shopping experience? Calm, bright lights and pleasant music, lots of open space, the ease of purchase, the lure of coming in. Actually, no, that's absolute garbage. If you're talking about the memory of the experience of the purchase, what really counts is what you overcame. What you overcame to achieve your purpose, your purchase, that's the thing that becomes the memory of what is a great retail experience. And as they put it, the perfect retail experience is one pair of shoes over a crevice filled with burning coals with a rickety-looking rope on it. Because if you can get those shoes back and you can buy them, that is achievement. That is the chance to really feel like you did something through your purchase. And this is really interesting because what we discover is it's absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the consumption. The consumption is almost irrelevant to it. It's about creating the experience of continuous consumption. That's the pursuit of continuous consumption. That's the important thing. Let's jump away for a second from retail. What's actually good? Well, one of the things that psychologists consider to be a very positive experience for happiness is gardening. Gardening's almost perfect. The reason that gardening's almost perfect is it's a continuous cycle of strife, work, achievement. This is what makes people happy. It's achievement through work. It's the feeling that the thing you've got was achieved through something valuable you did. And the beauty of a garden is, this time of year, all that work in the summer, you're so tired, and it dies. But you don't fall down in tears, because in a couple of months, well, I might, but that's because I never get as much done this year as I wanted to, but in a couple of months' time, it'll start again. And the things you put in last year do not come back. It's not a repetition. They don't come back like they did last year. They come back a bit bigger, and they grow, and some stuff is going to have to come out, and more stuff's going to go in. Some things will die off. It's a continuous process of achievement, a sense that there's some value in what you do. And this is important anthropologically. In fact, it's most incredibly important anthropologically. Because despite what the modern capitalist world tells you, if you look at humanity through lots and lots of different eras and lots of different cultural circumstances, the belief that we are profit-maximising beings is absolutely and demonstrably not true. This has been done a lot. This is serious work has been done in this. Under almost any circumstance, given the condition that, first of all, people are secure and doing okay, they're not going to starve, and second of all, that as part of their peer group, they do not drift too far away from the whole. So everybody moves however they move, broadly in the same position. Given these two things a standard, which was the standard for most societies for most of forever, given these two things, if someone then gets a choice to have either more money through longer hours or more time to themselves, they pick more time to themselves. And this has been shown over and over again. Humans, by nature, seek subsistence and then a range of other things which are not naturally consumption. The things that we tend to naturally seek out are things which reinforce our self of our sense. We are comparatively anxious creatures, humans. We need constantly to know that we're okay, that we did okay, that we are liked, that we are part of something. We're surprisingly fragile while being incredibly, incredibly resilient at the same time. But this sense of seeking out, the sense that, hey, you're okay, it's okay, largely finds its expression in the family, in friendships, in general sense of socialisation, in a general sense that there was something that you did that was worth it, which is one of the reasons why religion is such an effective way of making people feel popular. It brings you into a community. It gives you a sense that this community is worth something more than you individually, that it's of some value, that by doing this, you are in some way creating a better society, a better community. And that brings happiness and a sense of relief and a sense of self-justification. It is okay to be me because I am basically a good person, which is reflected in the community in which I live and my contribution to it. Now that is a large part of what makes people happy. You'll of course be familiar, well, I'm assuming you'll be familiar because I think most people have started to be, of all the work in the spirit label, the analytical piece, which tells you what are the social and economic outcomes of greater levels of equality in society. And the answer is, virtually everything gets better almost straight away. Status anxiety is possibly the single most iniquitous thing that was created by the 20th century among its many, many horrors. Status anxiety, the belief that somehow those around you are leaving you behind and you may not be quite good enough to keep up with them, that, more than anything else, is the thing which is destroying the fabric of our society. to be placed perpetually in a competition, and it is a competition, to be placed perpetually in competition with the people who are supposed to be the ones who contain within them the reinforcement of your value, of the fact that you are worth it because you are part of a community, because you are part of something. To be put in competition with those people is, as far as I'm concerned, absolutely abhorrent. It's a horrible thing to be done, and it creates nothing but insecurity. And this is where, in some regards, we're better off if we're actual livestock, because actual livestock in actual farms, a farmer will tell you, are best when they're docile and content. We are best when we're docile and uncontent. We would be better being a cow. If we were treated like a cow, at least they would make sure we were fed and not under pressure. Well, that cortisol affects the milk. And this is what it's about, because all of this becomes about psychoactives. This is all about neurotransmitters. The impact of all of this stuff has a direct health impact. I am not a bioscientist, but the effect of cortisol on your brain and your body is significant. Ongoing stress is a physical experience. You physically feel it. Your muscles tighten up. It does all sorts of things to leave you in a state of exhaustion. The rise and fall of dopamine in your brain as you achieve things and you don't achieve things. Fine, if it's real achievement and it's happening in some sort of natural order. But in modern hyper life, the dopamine's there and it's gone. And then it's there and it's gone. And it's there and it's gone. It is an addiction of neurotransmitters which affect our behaviours and everything that we do. And just in case anyone had forgotten, all of this is not accidental. This is to make a shop. The sole purpose of making a shop and keeping us out of the way. Because what happened next was, and by the 1990s, they'd moved this into a whole new realm, a whole new thing. The best example is probably the concept of the millionaire next door. This is the idea that at a point in the early 90s, wealth was democratised. Anyone could be rich. The, you know, that snowboarding thing. Work hard, work very hard, and then snowboard at the weekends. That's brilliant. And this idea that was creating a democratised wealth, democratised experience for us all, was a very important thing. Because inherent in it, at the core of it, was one message, which wasn't even particularly disguised, but it was there all the time, which was, and for the love of God, don't get involved in politics. Don't worry about life. Life is a lifestyle choice. Select your weekend hobby. Select which of these four off-the-peg identities suits you best and inhabit it with everything you can. You, sir, I can see you're going to be Sky Television, sports, three nights a week in the pub, lots of eating out, and big, big entertainment systems. You, sir, you're inactive. You'll have two expensive mountain bikes, all the gear to go with it, and you'll consider yourself very virtuous because you're taking exercise. Thank you, sir. Goodbye. Anything to stop us actually engaging with the reality, the real fabric of our society. Anything that makes us feel like we're actually alive, short of being actually alive. This was a big shift that started to happen throughout the 80s and the 90s. This is fairly straightforward because the period from 1945 until about 1975, people started to take a view about the society in which they lived. This is the society in which I want to live. Oh my God, we can achieve it. Look, we nationalised the core infrastructure, which prior to that, and I don't think, I might be saying no here, I don't think current generations understand this. I'd like to take some of the nippers. Nah, I'm starting to sound old. I'd like to take some of the nippers and say, do you know what it looks like when you don't have an NHS? It wasn't always here. It wasn't always like this. That was so successful, that period, between about 1945 and about 1975, that every indicator that you would care to look at came good. We compressed income scales. We ended many of the mortal illnesses. And I'd like to point out here, take this away and see if you can persuade people, tax as much as medicine did that. It's more about tax. It was more about the collective provision than it was about the scientific advance. The taxes, and I don't always get cheered when I say this, tax is, to my mind, perhaps the single highest achievement of civilization that we have yet met. Tax within a democratic society, the belief that at a large level we can collectively say from each according to ability to each according to need, to To achieve that is a massive, massive achievement in our society. And what it did, that tax money, was built the modern world that we have out there now. Proper infrastructure for all, proper health for all, and a proper sense that this is a shared community. Democratic, the democratic nation state with progressive taxation is our highest level of civilization, in my view. And it has done some wonderful things. It's done that thing, and I need to try and remember the quote, the greatest act of civilization is to plant a tree you will never rest under. That is what taxation is about. This is what we've achieved through all of that stuff. And it was so successful that it absolutely, definitely had to be broken down. It had to be destroyed. And that's what happened. They called it Thatcher. So it's an unfortunate situation that we find ourselves in. And we can turn this around. I said I was going to talk about happiness. It's all been misery. One last thing that I want to talk about before I come back to the happiness element, and I'm keeping an eye on time here, is relationships. And this is another area which is quite difficult and quite complicated to really come to terms with. Actually, I'll roll two in together here, which is relationships in our relation to society. So, freedom makes us happy, right? Well, this one we're going to have to deal with, and there's no way around it, because it is a rather perplexing contradiction. Actually, no, freedom tends to make us unhappy. This is the enemy identified by Durkheim. If you look at all the measures of society and the extent to which absolute free action is, at least in theory, possible, those societies tend to have much lower levels of happiness. The reason for this is very high levels of social freedom tend to throw us into a relationship with the market and our environment, which is completely unmediated. What is it that I am supposed to do with my freedom? What is it that I am supposed to do with this unlimited range of choices? It's that sense of standing in a shop, knowing you want a chocolate bar, and just going, what are these? I don't even know. I'm walking out of the shop without a chocolate bar. We get home, get all the choices in the world, and you're sitting, where's my chocolate bar? I used to be able to do this. I used to be able to go to a shop and buy a chocolate bar, and now I can't. This sense that excessive, endless amounts of freedom make us happy isn't measurably true. It makes a very small proportion happy. Am I therefore suggesting that we should go into highly patriarchal societies in which everyone does what they're told? No, of course I'm not. I think it's a complicated question that we haven't really addressed and we have to start to think about. Freedom does not make us inherently happy. Relationships do, or they did. And this is another area. Relationships still do make us very happy. But we've lost the capacity, in some extent, to understand relations, because my personal view, for much of the existence of humanity, from your birth, you could probably guess in a gene pool of not that many who were possible marriage contenders. It wasn't the kind of Greek notion that just splits you from your perfect other half and casts them to other parts of the world, and your whole life is to reassemble your one perfect self. That wasn't the truth. The truth was we lived in comparatively small communities, and the marriageable gene pool at any given point was comparatively small. And our expectations of that matched. You met somebody you liked, that you liked to spend time with, and that you thought you could build a life with. And that was a fundamental building block for relationships, which worked. They did work. Now, we're not perfect about these things, but it was a more realistic statement of where we are. Then came, to some extent, the Penny Dreadful, and absolutely certainly Hollywood, which stops every romantic comedy ever just before the first fight. You know, Harry Met Sally did not get through the whole rest of their life really happy and chuffed. It's not how it works. The decision to curtail the story of relationships at a moment of perfection has left us with a real problem. It's left a massive expectation gap, which bluntly, I suspect very, very few people can actually attain. How many people are actually endlessly, ecstatically happy simply through the presence of another person forever? I'm extremely happy in my relationship, but we fight quite a bit. I mean, she's my partner's Mexican, and her and my daughter are away just now. So I'm currently running my way through all the TV that she won't watch when I'm there, which involves kung fu movies, which I love because we're Bali fans, and as far as I'm concerned, that's just Bali with slapstick in between. So I'm getting through that just now. And we argue over it and we fight over it. And we have a realistic expectation that, you know what, it's not meant to be perfect. And this has made us, left us in a problematic situation. The rate of relationship breakdown that we have in society just now is seriously problematic. And we're replacing it with something else. I'm going to swear unpleasantly here, but there's no way kind of around this. Well, there is, actually. I could just not talk about it, but I think we should. Sex is another issue which is greatly worrying me. That sounds bad. If we look at the internet and the portrayal of sexual relations now, I am extremely worried. Not Ian McEwan. Martin Amis has got a book called Black Dog, which is largely about male sexual attitudes. And in it, he goes out, one of the characters ends up in Los Angeles in the kind of porn area where they make a lot of the porn movies. And they're going over all of the forms of pornography. There's some genres of pornography that they've got, and he's listing them all. He's listing them all at the end of them all. He says, and then, of course, there's the hate fuck, which is exactly what it says, the hate fuck. And he pauses for a second and says, of course, they're basically all hate fuck. Now, that in itself is a revelation which petrifies me. I don't think we understand what we are doing through the consumerization of human relationships, and particularly sexual relationships. I don't think people understand the difference between a generation coming through who see hate fuck as normal, who see this sort of relationship between people as a sort of normal thing that you can see on any computer monitor screen anywhere. And all of these things, all of them, what links them, every single one of them, all the way back to the beginning? Profit. It's profit. It's the excessive reliance on profit to measure and move our society. Now, about a minute ago, I got flashed that you've got 5 minutes to go, and I'm supposed to be optimistic and sort this out at the end. So let me do like this. Because we can, absolutely can. We need to think about this absolutely carefully and clearly. We have to kick back and we have to say, this is no way to run society and there's no way to run affairs. I am absolutely sick fed up of one social philosophy dominating our society for as long as I have been alive. A social philosophy which says there are two kinds of people in the world. There are wealth creators and there are livestock. Wealth creators are the best people. They're the best people because they have more money. More money is the measure of them being better. Because they have more money and because they are better, we should get out the road and let them run things as they see fit. Because conflict always wins. Conflict is the Darwinian proof that whoever wins any battle is the best person at any given time. And that is the only political and social philosophy that we've had in Britain since I was able to read. It doesn't matter whether you call it meritocracy in schools, which some of you may actually think is a good thing. You may actually think it's good that because one kid can pass an exam, he'll have a brilliant life. And because another kid can't pass an exam, yeah, he's just going to be sweeping the streets. Hey, it's meritocracy. No, it's not. It's an acceptance that we allowed a conflict model to lead to consign somebody to a life of misery and poverty simply because they didn't meet a test that we arbitrarily set. For the love of God, could we start off by abolishing the Department of Child Assessment? Let's create a Department of Education again. We can do this if we get rid of a conflict model of everything we do in society. Let's get away from retail. Oh, I'm down to 2 minutes and I've got to fix this in 2 minutes now. Let's get rid of retail. Let's think, what would the opposite of consumerism be? Now, this is, I maybe could have thought this through a little bit before I've done it because I'm still kind of developing this a little bit in my head. But I'd like to come up with a way of saying, what about activism? And I don't mean political activism. How about we start to create a sense that we are using our spare time and our resources to do things rather than to own things? It doesn't rip out a large part of our economy overnight. It says, instead of saving up for a pair of shoes, save up and we'll make it possible to go for a weekend break somewhere in Scotland. To go and do active things, and I don't mean the hyper-commercialised, I just mean things that are involved in reassuring. And we can do that. We can absolutely do something about the economy. We can take all the steps that are necessary to change our economy away from a pointless retail economy to the sorts of economies they've got in the Nordic countries where people make things, and through creating the value in the country, it builds a high-wage society. A high-wage society is a flatter society. We know everything good comes from a flatter society. We know how to do this. It's not something you do overnight, and it's not a doddle. It's going to require hard work. Remember, hard work makes you happy as long as you achieve things. It's going to take hard work, but we know how to do this, and we can build it. But perhaps above all, we need to retake the process of governance back for us. One of the key problems all of this happens is the remoteness of decision making. We have in Scotland the most centralised political culture in all of Europe, all of the developed world. Our local democracy is so pitifully weedy that we can't make any decisions. Local authorities in this country can do pretty well whatever they want in the back room with whatever service company they choose to come in and outsource whatever the hell it is they choose to outsource. And we've got virtually no capacity to hold that to account. Likewise, somewhere like Westminster has become such a self-enclosed bubble, physically and literally barricaded all the way round with large metal barricades to make sure that we understand that what takes place in there is something exclusive. We can change all of this. I've got to say I'm an independent supporter, and not here to evangelise particularly on that, but one of the reasons that I am is that I believe that the closer that we can bring democracy to people, the closer we can bring these things together, the more people's consent will be reflected in their government. The state is nothing more than an agreement between its citizens. It must work with the consent of those citizens. If we can do that, we can change lots of things. My sort of long-term political dream for global happiness would be, for example, the defederation of the United States of America. What a fascinating 52 countries that would make. Each one of them capable of reflecting the different views of the members of that society. We need to retake government and bring it back. And once we do that, we can start to regulate the process of destroying our psychic well-being. And just one closing suggestion for how we might do that. For every 2 minutes of advertising that we face in this country, let's just start off with a half minute of anti-advertising. Because it sounds so nice, anti-advertising. It goes like this. Your hair's nice. Your car looks okay. That's a nice house you've got there. Oh, your wife's lovely. How about you and do something fun? Thanks.